my chance for crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Grass make the heaven the middle. We are grass make the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with my co-host.
Charlotte Littlefield. Good evening, George.
Oh, good evening, Charlotte. We're going to be discussing The Pentagon's Brain. It's a book by Annie Jacobson. We'll be bringing her on the second half of this hour. And what did you think about that so far? I know you've got a copy, a review copy, and they sent me one. And it's 552 pages long. And what – my gosh, it's quite a book, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And she's quite a writer. I mean, it's jam-packed with information. I mean – it's incredible.
Yeah, you know, in the book, what preceded DARPA is what the book is about, and DARPA stands for the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, and originally it was ARPA, Advanced Research Projects Agency, when it first started. But in her book, she says that in the 50s, when Sputnik went up, you weren't born then, were you, Charlotte?
No, George, this is it's all news to me sometimes.
Well, Sputnik was the first satellite put up by the Russians, okay? And what happened was it put the focus, American public's focus, on the Soviet Union as having developed a rocket or a missile that could launch a satellite that circumvented the world. And all it did was go beep, beep. You know what I mean? But we remembered it. We could, I'm not sure if we could see that one later satellites we could actually see in the sky. But, we heard it go beep, 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 and there was focus in. And what that did was it made the American public aware that the Soviets were further ahead in missile technology than the Americans. And Werner von Braun, Annie wrote two previous books, to this latest one. But Annie Jacobson was the author of Area 51, and then also she followed that with the Project Paperclip and the 51.
You mean Operation Paperclip.
Yeah, Operation Paperclip, excuse me. Yeah, her first book was Area 51, and then she followed that book with Operation Paperclip. And
she has a, George, forgive me for interrupting, she has a website. And it's her name spelt, and it's Annie, A-N-N-I-E, Jacobson, J-A-C-O-B-S-E-N. I guess it's .com, wouldn't it be?
Yeah, that's it, AnnieJacobson.com. We're going to have that up on our website this evening. We already have that up, but thank you for reminding me about that, Charlotte. And she'd written a book, like I said, 552 pages, including the index, and it goes into a historical layout of DARPA. It actually started with ARPA. But getting back to this ICBM problem that was created because of this Sputnik, see, when that went up, then what happened next was there was a military aspect of having missiles that could launch something up into orbit like that immediately was red flagged as, uh-oh, ICBMs. How many do the Russians have, see?
Right.
And her,
well, tell me more about it because, as you know, I'd love to hear more about it.
Yeah. Herb York, who headed up the research group, we prepared a report for Congress and for the president, and they stated in there that there were virtually thousands of ICBMs ready to go aimed at America that the Soviets had, the Russians, which was a total exaggeration at the time. And they only had, eventually, they only had 4 missiles.
Okay.
Wow. So that was, but what it did was fuel the arms race, see? And what's interesting about this, Charlotte, you brought this up the other day about the Dulles brothers, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, Stephen Kinter wrote a book called The Dulles Brothers, and we interviewed, him a while back, been a while. But in there, he said that what happened there was, and this is important as sort of an adjunct type of information to what happened on the ICBM, is that the brothers were fueling a political Cold War. See, one was a CIA director, Allen Dulles, and his brother John Foster Dulles was Secretary of State. So between, they spoke daily, and they envisioned and you could say hyped up a Soviet Union that was dangerous and had to be dealt with. Then, when this Sputnik went up, then the military said, uh-oh, ICBMs are there. Then Herb York puts out a report that says there's virtually thousands of ICBMs the Russians have. And then you can imagine what that did, see?
Okay, wow.
Is that set up an arms race and a Cold War, an arms race between the Soviet Union and America? Now, what was interesting about this was JFK was, at that time, in the 60s, before he was assassinated, was more, he was determined to pull out of Vietnam at the time. See? But that would not fuel a military-industrial complex for money-making, and neither would it affect a political type of focus, as the enemy was the Soviet Union, that the American people could be focused against, see. And so JFK, you know, that was one of the reasons why, you know, people would, you know, theorize that they assassinated him. What did you think about that interview that we did up at the Texas School Book Depository, Charlotte, that year we went up there for 4 hours at JFK?
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun, I remember.
Yeah,
talked to Alan Watt.
Yes, Alan Watt started out, and then John Judge came in. John Judge was head of COPA, I think it was. And
do you remember the acronym, what it meant?
It had to do with assassinations. I'll get it in a second here. What that group focused in on was a JFK assassination, a Martin Luther King assassination, and the Robert Kennedy assassination, and I believe Malcolm X assassination. And so,
yeah, was there citizens against
political stuff?
Assassinations.
Well, I think it was COP. Could be COPA. COPA. Yeah, citizens. Against political assassination, something like that. But anyway, John Judge was quite instrumental and insightful during that interview up there. But getting back to this, JFK got in the way of the military-industrial complex. He got in the way of the Dulles brothers wanting a political boogeyman in the way of the Soviet Union. So all this did was fuel ARPA, you know, which was operating at the time in the 60s in Vietnam, and they went over to Vietnam shortly after JFK. Well, during his early presidency, I think ARPA was authorized to be in South Vietnam and starting to do research about the insurgency question there in Vietnam.
Fascinating.
But what was interesting in her book is that there were two projects over there that didn't go too well, and one was both you and I have talked to her a little bit independently outside of this, so we can even relate some of those conversations here, probably be more insightful. But in talking to her about this book previous to this broadcast, she was saying that the Ho Chi Minh Trail was a way to get arms and supplies from North Vietnam to South Vietnam. And so there was a theory, not a theory, but a project that was hatched to drop what? A listing devices, detection systems along the trail, and then monitor that trail for traffic. And then they could, if there was traffic on the trail, they could go in and bomb the trail. But it had to do with dropping these bomblets, you know, and some could take a foot off, and maybe some were like firecrackers, but that would activate some of the detection systems or so forth. It just got too complicated, it sounds like to me. And what is it about men and scientists, Charlotte, where they'll dwell on the science and forget about the common sense application of what they've come up with? What do you think?
Well, you know, she pointed out early in with the talks I had with her that the guy that was in charge of the hydrogen bomb was actually 24 years old.
Yes, yes.
And that's pretty young to have that kind of authority.
Yeah, I mean, it was like, you know, when I was 15, I drove my aunt to Louisiana and back. And I almost had a head-on collision because of my judgment was not that good at 15 driving. I was a new driver. And to put me on the highway was not probably very smart, but I made it. But, you know, barely. I almost had a head-on collision. So young people don't have the judgment that your older people have. And they're not as cautious. They're more rash and so forth. So, but talking to her over the last few days and over the phone and getting ready for this interview, she's so insightful, isn't she, Charlotte?
Absolutely, George. Just fascinating to hear and listen to.
Yeah, she has a grasp for this. And she also said over the phone that I'm one of the few guys that brought up the Herb Yark angle about the exaggeration of the ICBMs. And she said no one else that had been talking to her had gotten on top of that particular that angle. Now, there was another thing, project, and it centered around Agent Orange in Vietnam. And have you met people that have suffered from Agent Orange, Charlotte?
Perhaps. I've shared waiting rooms with them. I'm not certain, though, George.
Well, I had a personal friend that I used to have coffee with all the time, and he was so messed up, he had to go to a homeopathic physician and migrate some of that stuff out. See what I mean? He kept going to VA, but the VA was not helping him to get rid of some of this problems, this toxic chemicals in his body, and finally he had to go do that. Well, what Agent Orange had to do, according to her in her book here, is that they were wanting to start conflagrations that would burn the enemy out, see, in their sanctuaries inside these jungles. And so this defoliant called Agent Orange would be used, and then also it would dry up the leaves and cause an ability to hopefully to start a fire that would just rage through these whole areas, see, where they were practicing this defoliant dropping spraying. But it didn't work. The monsoon season was too wet, and the dry season, it was still too wet because of humidity and so forth in the air. So there were two examples right there where in Vietnam, the Ho Chi Minh Trail, the detection system or the monitoring system did not work. It was too complicated. And then this burning the enemy out, that didn't work either. And I think in her book and so forth, she makes a point about insurgencies are hard to beat with just technology. What do you think, Sharon?
Oh, she studied it far more than I, and I think she's on to something, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you think that you can solve anything, any problems with technology, but it has limits. Now, one of the examples later on was not only Vietnam, but over in Somalia and Mogadishu, where Black Hawk Down, is that what it was or something like that?
Yes.
That's more current. So when they had to go in, there's an old saying from a famous warrior that you don't fight in cities, right? Huh?
I would hope. Yeah, yeah. I would hope.
So every time that we went into a city, Fallujah was one example in Iraq, was it not? And then you had the Mogadishu problem where we got cut up. We took out some of their people, but we got, you know, torn up pretty bad because we were inside a city. When you're inside the city, then it makes the battlefield even, because technology is not as effective inside these cities. She does get into in this book about the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, and they're able to take resources like satellite imaging and so forth, and do studies and really zero in. And I think they were doing some of that in Iraq toward the end of our occupation over there. And but also that we get back to some of this early funding of the Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Streets Act of 1968, where they created a law enforcement assistance agency and funded it with $12 billion over 10 years. Now, boy, that didn't, and that was enabling many of your police, local police, to get equipment that was military in use. You said something about Posse Comitatus, Charlotte?
Yeah, I did, George. On the previous interview.
Yeah, right. Our previous hour with Whitehead, and that went real well. John Whitehead is very, very, very good at that. So y'all tune into that also. That was our first hour this evening, Saturday night. We're live here on Austin Radio, 7 to 9 every Saturday night on 89.1. You can come in and click off and do the on demand. Listening to our programs also. So the technology that is not an all is not a panacea for everything, is it? Huh?
No, it's not. However, it's not beyond the pale that we'll have, you know, more UFO sightings. Maybe that will actually be drones.
Yeah, it could.
And
well, now,
like pre-crime units.
Oh my gosh, pre-crime units. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, the technology. You know, you can, depending on who's using it and what they're doing with it.
Yeah,
it could really put a damper on our liberties and our freedoms.
Yeah, that's what I'm afraid of, and I think Annie Jacobson thinks the same way that we do, and she voiced concerns over the telephone, but she did say something about the second book, the Operation Paperclip. Is that right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. It opened her eyes to all the Nazis that had been smuggled into this country that were working in the defense industry in this country. And she also said that the Defense Department was going to bring Werner von Braun into the Pentagon, but he wanted to bring, what, 12 other men with him? And they were all former Nazis, and the Pentagon thought that's just too much, right? So
right.
It didn't work out, but he stayed inside the defense industry and helped develop many of our first missiles and rockets that would help us launch satellites and so forth. The DARPA today, though, there was a story in her book about dragonflies around. You remember Lafayette Park there in Washington, right north of the White House, Charlotte?
Oh yeah, sure.
Yeah, you know, there's a story that she has in her book, and what she does is she has a history, a very historical, you could say. Laid out over time, and then she sprinkles in there some really firsthand stories about people's experiences. In there, she says there were individuals in that park that began to see these dragonflies flying around the park, but they weren't real dragonflies; they were little drone surveillance insects.
Well, that's what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we can expect to be surveillanced or, you know, to have these kind of things intrude into our space.
Exactly. Well, you know, recently, hasn't there been some drones that have been shot down in someone's backyard? Huh?
Well, not that I've seen recently, but, yeah, I was familiar with the case. It was a few weeks old for sure, yeah.
So
the guy shot it down, but he ended up in trouble. It seemed that he needed to reimburse for the $1,800 drone or whatever it was, the camera.
Yeah, but there, again, if it's over his property, can you shoot it down? Is it legitimate then?
Well, I would hope so, but on the other hand, I don't know. What do you think?
Well, it depends on what that drone is being used for. Now they're being used for, like, real estate. To observe real estate properties and to get a bird's eye view maybe of a real estate property and then to put it into multiple, I guess, or whatever. And I think there's a service here in Austin that can do that, legitimately. But people are flying these drones with those cameras on all over the place, I think.
Wow.
They're beginning to be a problem around airports, though. That could be dangerous, see. You know, you get a drone sucked into an engine, it could probably mess up the engine, couldn't it? Huh?
Oh, definitely.
Oh, like a bird, you know, could well,
sure.
Remember, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's a hazard, and that's a genuine hazard.
Yeah, that's true. But so we've got to work through some of those questions in the future, that's for sure. Getting back to this book, the book is, like I said, a large book. It gets into some, like, killer robots. What did you think about that part of it, Charlotte? These killer robots. Isn't that scary? Huh?
Yeah, most certainly.
And what, autonomous, yeah. She gets into talking about them becoming autonomous, right?
Yeah, she stresses that artificial intelligence, though, hasn't been, you know, actually realized yet. And so, therefore, these robots really, they don't have the autonomous yet, but they're like forever on the verge of it.
So the AI had not been perfected enough. Enough to make them fully autonomous. But when you say fully autonomous, what does that mean? They're thinking like we do? Huh?
I don't know.
Are you kidding
me? I wouldn't know.
No,
it's scary.
Huh? It is. And then it gets back to who programs them with this stuff. Huh?
Absolutely. I mean, that's going to be hopefully something that's not realized.
I hope not. These institutions, and she made a point of this on the phone the other day, is that they've grown so large, see, and they're so money-driven. That, you know, I mean, what are we going to do with it? I mean, what, you know, they're very powerful. And when agencies and institutions become very powerful, they always, they abuse that power, right?
Sure, why not? I mean, that's what the revolving doors and the.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you.
That's what it's all about.
Yeah, that's right. So. I mean, it gets to be, you know, bigger and bigger problems. Now, our earlier interview with John Whitehead, and if you didn't catch that on the air broadcast, go back in to thesecrettruth.com and call that back up. That's up there for demand after our broadcast is over with. So go ahead in there and if you missed it, and pick it up from that. John Whitehead has some really eye-opening things to say, too. But getting back to this Pentagon brain, Patrick Wood, okay, has written a book recently called Technocracy Rising, okay? Brzezinski wrote a book back in the 70s, and one of the subtitles was Technotronic Era, okay? Well, Patrick Wood maintains today that that was mislabeled or mistitled. It should have been Technocracy Era. See what I mean? Because And we're going to be bringing this up at the beginning of our second hour. I'm going to bring up the idea or the fact that that Harold Brown, okay, was one of the first, you could say, technocrats that was Secretary of Defense. See? But he was highly trained, and he knew the technical aspects of these weapon systems that they were presenting to the Defense Department. So in the future, and it's already here already, the future is here now, isn't it? We have a lot of the higher-level people are technocrats, and they're very, very astute and very knowledgeable at what they do. There was a couple of things in this book called the Jason Group, okay? But also there's a Jason Society, and I think the public, our listening audience, can look up both of these. Look up the Jason Society. That's much more oriented to MJ-12 and after the Roswell incident. And the Jason Group was created to augment research and a brain trust for the ARPA, and eventually it was evolved into DARPA. So the Jason Group is a more recent creation, even though the Jason Society, some maintain, is still there and existing. But there are many of these two groups sometimes get mixed up one with the other.
Mm-hmm.
What other things did you pick up in the book, Charlotte?
Oh, well, not as much as you, George. It was just full of so much information. It was like taking water out of a fire hose. I mean, it was just jam-packed with information.
Yeah.
And she starts out with her opening chapter, The Evil Thing,
right.
Cold War, Part 1. I thought it was a great history lesson for anybody that, you know, didn't know what happened there.
Right.
Talking about Castle Bravo. Bomb, the bomb that Edward Teller, they had...
tell us about
that. They designed the... Well, I don't know entirely. I would recommend people get the book and read it.
Right.
But basically, they didn't calculate the megatonnage correctly. And when they detonated, they had a detonation that was 200 times larger than they had forecasted, which
right.
was quite serious. It was a hydrogen, you know, bomb, so...
Well, they were speculating to drop a few of those types of bombs in the Soviet Union and devastate it. Okay, that was one of the proposals, or in the 50s, I believe. See, and there was this thing about the Rosenbergs helping the Soviets steal some of the hydrogen bomb secrets out of New Mexico. Okay, and the story goes there is that the Army Security Agency was intercepting those communications between the Russians and the Rosenberg group, and the Russians were using a one-time pad system, but they were not changing the keys. Okay, they were using the same key for a series of messages, two or three, and so we were able to compare those that they didn't change the key on and break those messages, and so the Army Security
Wow.
Agency actually it preceded the formation of the NSA. And at Arlington Hall is where we were doing the code breaking for the Rosenberg, spy network. And it was real. We couldn't bring that into court at the time. And, of course, this was years before I was part of the deal. So it's just history, you know, to me. But we couldn't bring that in.
Yeah,
we couldn't bring that in to court, you know, because it would expose means and methods. Now, this is where Snowden and his group, Greenwald and that Putras, a woman, are wrong in what they did with some of the material of Snowden. And this is where this is my opinion, but the means and methods, they went too far and revealed too many of our means and methods that we, you know, could have kept secret. And those are really the secret, the most secret things that the those NSA and ASA and those groups were trying to to keep a secret, you know. But some of the things that they reveal that threaten our domestic liberties and freedoms, that was very helpful. But the other things which reveal some of our means and methods was not good. That part wasn't. And the other thing that point I would make on that is that if they revealed any intelligence at the time that would hurt a military person on the ground, you know, in any way, well, then that would be wrong too. You know, because I'm for our troops, you know, our safety of our troops. But this thing in Syria, Charlotte, is really, there's one surprise after another.
Yeah, sure is.
There was reports of Cubans fighting over there, of all things.
Well, I think freedom fighters of any age or whatever, somebody swept away with some sort of ideology, maybe. I don't know. That's crazy. What are they doing there?
Well, in Africa, they went in there in Angola and other places in the past, and they were helping some of those African countries against our interests, okay? They were in there with the Soviets. See, the Soviets and the Cubans have been partners in some of the African operations in the past, okay? And so now you've got the Russians that have taken the initiative in Syria, and this is where our government just dropped the ball on that. But we were supporting ISIS and stuff. We're not true to doing what was right there, you know? So many people are saying, well, good if the Russians take out ISIS, you know? And a lot of your Americans are saying that. We've got,
really? Even the...
Yeah. The American public is warm to the Soviets in there taking out ISIS because we wouldn't do it. See what I mean? The American public, many of your smarter people, are on to what Obama and this administration have been doing. And so they are welcoming the Soviets in there to go after ISIS and to support Assad's government, because many Americans don't believe that it was a legitimate civil war to start with, and we were in contravention to international law anyway by being there. And the Turks have done the same thing. So it's just not right exactly for being there. It's like the Libyan, you know what I mean, civil war. We shouldn't have been there. See, we shouldn't be in Syria.
Yeah.
We shouldn't have been in Iraq. We shouldn't have been in Afghanistan, period. But
They
could easily use 9/11 and use that as to mesmerize the American public to go after that. Well, we're down to about 45 or 50 seconds. Anything to say before we bring on Annie Jacobson?
No, it's just it's wonderful to have her, and it's just a pleasure to. We're in for a treat.
Okay, we're going to start off with a question. Annie, what do you think about Harold Brown? He was the first technocrat, I guess, for the Secretary of State, and that's the first question that we're going to put forward when we begin the second hour with Annie Jacobson, author of The Pentagon's Brain. Charlotte, thank you very much for being with us, and we're going to continue on with Annie. Thank you. Bye-bye. The first technically trained or educated people that was a Secretary of Defense?
Yes, and that is very interesting note that you picked up on there, because what's interesting about Harold Brown, and he was, by the way, Herb York's protege. We talked about the first chief scientist at ARPA after Von Braun rejected the job or was rejected from the job. Herb York, the thermonuclear weapons engineer at Livermore Laboratory, was the first scientist. Harold Brown, this brilliant physicist, took over at the nuclear weapons laboratory when York left. He was only 24 years old, and yet he was in charge of thermonuclear development at Livermore. Later, he went and became the guy to whom all the ARPA scientists reported to during the Vietnam War. Played a major role in all of those Vietnam programs. And then, in 1977, he became the first Secretary of Defense that was a scientist. Now we have a Secretary of Defense who is a scientist again, by the way. Ash Carter is a technologist. But what was interesting was, I found, was people's perception of of Harold Brown being Secretary of Defense during the Carter administration was, wow, look at this. You know, Carter, the peace activist, well, now he's a peace activist, but the Democrat, you know, here he has chosen a scientist as Secretary of Defense. Isn't that gentle? Isn't that, I mean, these are my words, but that's kind of the sense that you get, that it was this idea of that somehow a scientist would be, you know, different, let's say, when in fact, and I'm trying to say this without judgment, it's just a fact that it was Harold Brown who transformed industry at the Pentagon to become science and technological based. So in other words, suddenly the idea was, which you then saw in the Gulf War, by the way, Gulf War I, was we, America, will create a vast weapon system that's based entirely on technology, information technology, computer technology, GPS, laser-guided bombs, drones, all of this, which everyone thinks of as present-day modern warfare. This was all born in the Vietnam War and fostered by Harold Brown during these decades of so-called no war. But in fact, it was the build-up for the next war, which was the Gulf War. And it's very interesting when you look at it like that and sort of realize, there was a lot going on there which was not known to the public.
Right, right. So the secrecy, do they not hide behind national secret types of labels and so forth? And we don't know what they're doing all the time, do we? I mean, because of national secrecy acts and so forth.
Well, yes and no. And this is where I think it's a really interesting conundrum that people should think about. I don't think it's as sinister necessarily as, you know, people at the Pentagon rubbing their hands together and going, let's secretly design all these weapons and not tell anyone. Although that is a part of it. You know, stealth technology is the best example. It took 15, 20 years to develop. No one knew about it. And it was unleashed on the Gulf War. And it just absolutely knocked the socks off of Saddam Hussein. And the whole war was lost, you know, very quickly. It was called a revolution in military affairs. That's the job of DARPA. But people are busy with their lives. And, you know, those decades between the Vietnam War and the Gulf War, everyone's sort of happy that there's no war, let's say. And sure, the military isn't being built up, but no one knows that all this science and technology is brewing at the Pentagon. And you kind of ask on balance, well, is it the average citizen's job to say, what's happening there at the Pentagon? Or are they busy with their lives, you know, earning a living, educating their children, enjoying, you know, being an American citizen? Well, that's the conundrum that I ask you to examine when I explain to you what is happening right now. And what I show in the end of the book is happening is that the Pentagon has made an absolute decision leading 25 years into the future to begin what is called autonomous warfare, to have hunter-killer drones that are not like drone operators at one end, and the, you know, that is a drone operator operating a predator drone is a, that's just a remote control in essence. What the Pentagon is planning on doing with DARPA leading the effort is creating robots that can actually go and hunt and kill on their own. And they're literally known as hunter-killer weapons. People often say, well, that's way off in the future. But I assure you, and as I report in the book, that it's DARPA is an agency that makes the future happen. And I show that they have been making the future happen since 1958. And they will make this future happen, which is an army of hunter-killer drones.
So, I mean, who's going to program all of that exactly? I mean, you know?
Yes. Well, it's a very important question because so there's four steps to get to autonomy. There's, you know, the situations we have now, which is where it's remote control. And then you have to move toward, according to the Pentagon, two steps of what's called semi-autonomy. So where you create drone systems, where you engineer in the ability for the drones to work among themselves. I'll give you one example. There's a little drone called a Landroid, because we have drones, by the way, a few people realize this, that are that walk, that crawl, that swims, that run. We have a drone system called Hydra that is a mothership underneath the ocean, has baby submersibles, like little mini submarines that shoot out robotically, then go to the surface and can launch a flying drone from that baby submersible. The system is called Hydra. You can look it up. You can read about it in my book. It sounds like science fiction. It's science fact. It exists. So DARPA has all these drones, and one semi-autonomous one is called a Landroid. And those little Landroids are about the size, if you open up your hand, you could fit one on your palm. And they have little treads on them, and they are used by what are called dismounted soldiers. So that's just a soldier in the field. So the soldier goes out, gets out of his Humvee, he's now dismounted, and he drops out of his pockets 4 or 5 Landroids. And what they are is they are essentially, imagine your iPhone, your cell phone. You know how you run out of cell phone coverage? Well, these 4 Landroids are like small cell phone towers. And the point, because they're in Afghanistan or Yemen or wherever they are, is they're trying to get signal to the soldier, because so much of it works on satellite technology. But the reason that there's 4 or 5 of them, and the reason they're important to consider, is because they're semi-autonomous. So they work with the soldier, but they work with themselves. So if one of them gets crushed or shot at or driven over, the other 4 will reconfigure themselves so that they can get that soldier the cell coverage, metaphorically, okay? And then you begin to see what self-governance is, meaning those Landroids have been programmed to act on their own. The operator is not telling them what to do, the dismounted soldier.
Oh, my God.
The final step, yes, okay? Now, the final step, which you asked, who programs this? So here's the key. The final step to have an autonomous weapon, and autonomy means self-governing. You're an autonomous thing, meaning you can make decisions on your own. You wake up and you say, I'm going to go get the mail. No one told you to do that. You just say, I'm going to get the mail. You go get the mail. You can even go visit the neighbor if you want. That's autonomy. You can do what you want, how you want it, okay? But we cannot have a weapon system that's autonomous, that's truly autonomous, until we have artificial intelligence. DARPA has been leading the way on the quest for artificial intelligence since the 1950s. No one has been able to yet break the barrier of artificial intelligence. So you hear, when you hear people like Bill Gates, Elon Musk, Stephen Hawking on television saying, we mustn't have AI weapons, they're too dangerous. The reason they're saying that is because they know there is not, that autonomy has not been attained yet. Artificial intelligence has not been attained. But that is what the Pentagon is going for. And what I propose in the book is that the way in which they are doing it is through the use of another program, which I find very suspect, which is where they are putting brain chips in veterans who have come back from the war. And the purpose of these brain chips, says DARPA, is to help brain-wounded warriors restore cognitive function. So in other words, a guy comes back from the war with an injury because shrapnel went into his brain and he's suffering from amnesia. Well, DARPA has programs that they call neuroprosthetics, where they are using these tiny sensors, these tiny chips implanted in soldiers' brains to try to learn how to help repair cognitive functioning. This has a parallel in the world of, you know, medicine, where, for example, Parkinson's disease, scientists are making great leaps forward in potentially one day being able to cure people of Parkinson's disease with these neuroprosthetics. But you have to ask, as some of the scientists I interviewed asked me, is that DARPA's real goal in the brain prosthetics program? Since DARPA's job is not to help soldiers, DARPA's job is to create weapon systems. And so what was posed to me and what I ask in the book is the real purpose of the DARPA brain programs to finally break that barrier of artificial intelligence and be able to give machines human intelligence?
Oh, my gosh. Man, this is getting deep, isn't it? I mean,
Oh yeah.
You have, yeah, don't you think? What do you think, Charlotte?
I'm transfixed. I'm fascinated. I'm hanging on your every word.
I tell you what, you have really done an in-depth study, Annie Jacobson, on this. And you have some really fine views, I believe. And I think the defense of liberty and freedom and all that, I think that's at the heart of some of your concerns, is it not?
Well, it is. And you know, what's also interesting is that these are also the concerns of many of these very dedicated defense scientists that I have interviewed. In other words, I really work hard as a journalist not to see anything necessarily in black and white, because it's important to realize that, you know, for example, DARPA's job is to make sure that America doesn't get taken by military technological surprise, right? So DARPA has an important job. I mean, imagine if Russia suddenly has hunter-killer artificially intelligent drones. I mean, then we really are in big trouble, and we're all going to say, wait a minute, where was DARPA? Okay? But this is that chicken and the egg conundrum where you say, who is leading and who is following and who is actually creating more of a military-industrial complex than trying to find a solution? And that, I think, is the heart of the matter that everybody, I would hope, gets to question and come up with their own answers from reading a book like this.
Right. We have to defend the country, that's for sure. But then are they coming up with any domestic terrorist types of research in your research
or operations other than war?
Yeah.
Yes, yes. I mean, you know, I have to tell you what, just as a journalist and also as a citizen who, you know, reads the newspaper every day.
Right.
Of course, it seems like there is no threat greater than Islamic State. Okay? So one can even imagine, yes, you know, the big superpowers, China, Russia, there's always that dance. And the dance is 60, 70 years old. And if you look at history, you realize we have successfully done the political dance with these two big nations, so as not to engage in war. And the real wild card is a terrorist organization like ISIS, where certainly like Al-Qaeda was, where the threat is unpredictable. And out of all of the programs and all of the that DARPA has worked on, that I have studied and that I write about in the book, the one area where they are not only weak, they're almost blind, is fighting against a terrorist threat.
Right. Well, Mogadishu there in Somalia, was that an example?
Yes, you're absolutely right. And that is where that was the first time. So when Black Hawk Down, let's call it, happened.
Yes.
The Pentagon, DARPA, you know, the military folks in Washington were really kind of high on the hog, so to speak, still having come off the Gulf War, which was such a crush, for lack, you know, whether or not we took out Saddam doesn't, separate from that, just in terms of military might, it was a crush. Okay? And there was kind of a restored, renewed sense of military prowess. Well, that all was upset very quickly by the Battle of Mogadishu, because suddenly the Pentagon, specifically DARPA, had to deal with the fact that urban warfare was not something anyone was prepared for. And one of the most interesting documents I read about that was, you know, one of the things that DARPA does, is they look to think tanks to write reports for them. And they look to the Rand Corporation, who wrote them a report, and it started with a quote from Sun Tzu, which said, "It's a terrible policy to attack cities." This is a Chinese general talking 2,500 years ago. And really, nothing has changed. I mean, fighting in a city is unwinnable. It's impossible. Just look at Syria. Just look at Iraq. No one can do it with technology. And the enemy always has the upper hand because they are using, quote-unquote, civilians as cover. And there is no way to differentiate between a civilian and a terrorist fighter. And that is a great problem, and I believe that DARPA knows that. and they're trying all kinds of ways around that, all of which are focused on technology, most of which are focused on surveillance, which goes back to that original idea born of ARPANET in the Vietnam War, which we talked about, which was the electronic fence.
Right. But there was one thing that they did under HURT, H-U-R-T, at the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. I think they were marshaling those resources. Was that successful at all?
I mean, you're absolutely right. That was, well, that was, that's sort of the same idea. And HURT was this unfortunately named program. This is what HURT stands for. It's a mouthful. It was called Heterogeneous Urban Reconnaissance, Surveillance, and Target Acquisition. Okay.
Right.
HURT was like they later realized that was not a very good name for a program where you're killing people, so they changed it to HART, which we won't even get into. But HURT relied upon drone technology and sensor technology in the urban war theater. So we sent contractors into their cities and essentially dropped sensors all over them. I mean, literally all over them. You can write about the numbers and the volume in the book to try and defeat the terrorists instead of, you know, fighting them, you know, in ground combat, kind of in these alleyways, but instead to determine through surveillance and intelligence reconnaissance who the terrorists were by seeing who was planting these IEDs in the road and then being able to go in and arrest them. Well, it just didn't work, and there's a million reasons why I write about it in the book. But, you know, the technology has persisted, and those programs have gotten bigger. But in what I found fascinating in my research is no one would tell me, I would say, what happened to all that technology that was left behind in Iraq? And no one would say, so you kind of draw your own conclusion, which is that it stayed there, and now it's in their hands.
Okay. Well, let's just hope that that technology isn't beginning to be used here domestically. I mean, there's all kinds of rumblings, the militarization. There were some interesting points you made in your book about the Law Enforcement Assistance Agency under the Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Streets Act of 1968. You said in there that $12 billion was allocated over a 10-year period to assist local police. What is that about?
Mm-hmm. Well, that, you know, when I was reporting that part of the book, the situation was first happening in Ferguson, and there was those images I found fascinating about the militarization of the police force. And there was a lot of reports about how this had happened, you know, in the 80s, and that is not what I found out to be accurate at all. I found from my research and the declassified documents that I received through the Freedom of Information Act was that those programs actually began in, surprise, surprise, Vietnam. And they were born of the problems that the police were having controlling crowds during the Vietnam protests, the Vietnam War protests. And so what ARPA did was it set up these very secret bases in Vietnam, in Thailand, and began developing weapons. They called them non-lethal weapons for crowd control. So they were chemical agents. They were irritants. They were, you know, using like things like sonic boom and flashing lights. I mean, just horrible things, you know, that you can imagine to try to control crowds without crowds knowing they're actually being controlled. That's what the scientists, the ARPA scientists, were working on in Vietnam. Then you see those weapons being used a little bit, because this is still very classified, against protesters. And then the suggestion is that is what actually gave birth to this idea of police militarization later, because, you know, the one thing the government cannot handle is civil unrest. I mean, we know that to be true, absolutely. The government has serious problems with our, whether it's posse comitatus or different laws that we have governing against the use of the military in the United States. And so the police are given authority, and interestingly, the authority that they're given often comes from weapons that were born of the military.
Right. We've got about 5 minutes left, Annie Jacobson. What would be some of your concluding remarks, and is there anything that you'd like to state that we left out and glossed over?
Well, one of the things that I think people, it's well worth considering, is that, you know, just the other day, the DARPA director was at a convention in Aspen, and she said, everything is science fiction until it becomes fact. And this idea of merging man and machine that I write about in the end of the book, we talk about the hunter-killer robots, but DARPA also has a program which is called AugCog, which is augmenting human cognition. And it's the idea of making super soldiers. And I really think it's worth considering, because DARPA has already created two animal cyborgs. And, you know, 20 years ago, people would have absolutely called this science fiction. But I am talking about actual science that has allowed a U.S. military agency to merge an animal and a machine. And DARPA has done it with a rat. They call it Robo-Rat. And they implanted electrodes in the rat's brain, and the DARPA scientists were able to steer the rat through a maze. And they did it last year with a moth. So they inserted electrodes into the moth while it was still in the larva, the pupa stage.
Oh, my
okay?
gosh, yeah.
So when the little tiny electronic, DARPA calls it neuroprosthetics. You could call it a brain chip or a sensor. So then the moth grows its wings. It transforms. It has that period. And now the machine, that little tiny machine, is part of the moth. And DARPA scientists were able to steer the moth in flight. So this raises serious questions about free will. And in animals, people can look at it as sort of neat science. If you're not an animal rights activist, then it's going to be another story. But when you consider that DARPA is working on brain chip programs, and you consider that the Jason scientists who I interviewed in a written document to the Pentagon cautioned against this program specifically because they felt it could lead to high-quality brain control. That's their quote, not mine. That's really where I thought, I think it's unwise for people in this day and age to discount the idea that they should know about what is going on with DARPA's weapon systems of the future. I think that they should know, and a little bit of information gets you a long way.
Well, I tell you what, that's quite a statement, Annie. I really support your view there. Charlotte, how about any comments from you on closing here?
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to listen. Sorry I wasn't more involved. I just learned so much. Thank you, Annie.
Thank you so much for having me.
Boy, and I tell you what, you've got a fine book, The Pentagon's Brain, and do you have, we have it on Amazon and everything, do you have a website we could put up for you too, a personal one?
MyName.com.
.com. Okay, AnnieJacobson.com.
Yep.
Okay, we're gonna put that up also. But thank you so very much for being with us this evening. And you've written just a fine book, and you're really concerned about this country. And I can tell, you know, with your concluding remarks that you're really, really working for what's right and for this country.
Thank you so much. You guys have a great night.
Okay, thank you, Annie. Good night. Good night, Charlotte. Bye-bye.
Good night, George. Thank you.
Bye-bye.